Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
The post-Halloween blues are a real thing. The All Hallows Grieve, some are calling it.
Who's calling it that?
I heard it just now on a podcast.
Oh, okay.
And it's one you're listening to as well, folks. Welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. This is our feedback show for November, and we'll be reading your comments on the shows from The Lonesome October.
We spent that whole month on the Rogers Zelazny Halloween novel, The Night in the Lonesome October. After the whole thing was over, I was a little depressed. A feeling of the blues after Halloween that some are calling melancholoween. So it'll be good to revisit October once again.
Oh, man.
Let's start our first show on A Night in the Lonesome October. This is part one.
Michelle Albert writes, regarding the fictionalization of Jack the Ripper, I'm inclined to agree that it's been so buried in genre media that there's a disconnect, for better or worse. That being said, if the story tries to imply that the real historical victims attributed to Jack the Ripper were actually chthonic horrors defeated by him, it will sit less well with me.
Well, I believe it did try to do that, Michelle. We wanted it to be somebody else besides Jack the Ripper. We were investigating Springheel Jack.
Yeah.
Based on some other comments on this episode, Jack Tripper. Chris had a theory that this might be Jack Tripper from Three's Company.
Yeah.
Went on and on about it, but that didn't make the final show cut.
20-minute dissertation I've done on that. The way I explained it, it makes sense.
It did make sense the way you explained it. Professor Koschka writes, Chris, I want to thank you for reading out the names of Jack the Ripper's victims. We often have references to or appearances by Jack the Ripper in popular media, but it's rare for his victims to be specifically acknowledged. These women were real people who were murdered, and it's important for us to remember that when Jack the Ripper shows up in a story.
Shauna Carter says, Hallie Rubenhold has a podcast inspired by The Five called Bad Women. The first season, The Ripper Retold, focused primarily on the biographies of Nichols, Chapman, Stride, Ed Owes, and Kelly. The current season, The Blackout Ripper, is about a series of murders during the London Blitz.
Wow, cool. I'm going to have to check that out. So many podcasts don't ever get to. Speaking of podcasts, since this story does have a dog main character, we discussed other podcasts that may cover it.
Yes.
Funk writes, Dog Studies of Dog Stories and Strange Studies of Strange Stories? The Venn diagram intersects on characters with impressive canines. That's right. There's a lot of vampire content on here. Monster Talk writes, Guys, I know you know this, but I could hear you struggling to find a word for how Snuff, the dog, is referring to all these characters who appear to be somewhat generic models for broad classes of horror characters. They're not the real historical figures nor the specific literary ones. Clearly, they're bark types. Bark types.
I like that.
I do too.
Jennifer DeFord writes, I listen to this with the feeling you get when you introduce two wonderful friends you hope will get along.
Aww.
And Tamara Pikes writes, I just wanted to thank you. I used to read a lot when I was younger, but having two autistic children and working full time, I got lost in the daily grind of things. Listening to your podcast has reignited my love of reading, and now I have a lovely stack of stories to get through. Thank you again so much. Tamara, thank you so much. I'm so glad because when we do the show, I really hope people are reading along with us. Like, that's really the intent. And I get people are busy and you can't read as much. And sometimes it's okay to do the cliff notes of these things. But the fact that you're reading again, especially when, you know, I know how hard it is to raise kids. Gandalf Carter. Gandalf Carter. That's priceless. Thank you. Gandalf says, I played the Amber Diceless role-playing game in high school, and the game motivated me to read the stories. I never thought to check out Zelazny's other stories, but I am now. Better late than never, right? Thanks for the literary recommendations and nostalgia injection, guys.
You're welcome. Amber writes, okay, I love this, because in The Key of Solomon, 13th century grimoire translated by Mathers, it talks about how you need assistance to do magic, and if you can't find the proper humans, a dog will do.
What?
There's a quote here. When the master of the art wisheth to put in practice any operation or experiment, especially one of importance, he should first consider of what companions he should avail himself. This is the reason why in every operation whose experience should be carried out in the circle, it is well to have three companions. And if he cannot have companions, he should at least have with him a faithful and attached dog. It goes further to talk about how to prepare the dog. But if the master of the art wisheth to have a dog for his companion, he must bathe him thoroughly with the exercised water in the same manner as his disciples, and let him perfume him with the odors and incense of art, and let him repeat the following conjuration over him. I conjure thee, O thou creature, being a dog, By him who hath created thee, I bathe and perfume thee in the name of the Most High, Most Powerful and Eternal God, so that thou mayest be my true companion in this operation, and thou mayest be also my faithful friend in whatever operation I may hereafter perform. The human companions end up getting special clothes and weapons, but it's not clear if you should do the same for a dog. It goes further to say, you could also use a small boy or a girl, which is better than a dog, but big yikes.
Yeah. That's
crazy. I think
an
enchanted sweater would be appropriate, yeah, for the dog.
I do. Explosion the Aquarius writes, please, please, please do a bonus episode on Benicula. My husband Jack and I are huge fans.
You know, I loved that book too. I tried to rewatch the ABC Weekend Special animated version of the book from the 80s. I can't get through it. It's on YouTube. It's free. Yeah. But it's just sort of straightforward and dopey, and the sound's mixed really bad, so it's hard to watch. There's a new series called Benicula.
Yeah.
You can watch like on Boomerang, and I don't know what its host channel is, but that's well-liked, and I think it's pretty funny. However, looking at either of them and the book, I don't know if that would make a good episode, to be quite honest. Yeah. Because it's just a good kid's book. I definitely recommend that kids read it. I think it's an excellent children's book, but I don't know if it merits too much more analysis from us.
All right.
Convince me otherwise.
Fair enough. Night in Lonesome October Part 2. David Halstead writes, a friend and I got into watching So Bad They're Good movies a while back, and one of them was the 1976 movie entitled Embryo. In it, Rock Hudson is a scientist who rapidly grows a fetus into an adult woman and falls in love with her. What? But she turns into a homicidal maniac. Of course she would.
I think that's also the plot of Splice.
What?
With Adrian Brody.
Oh, right. Oh my God. Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I do remember going, what has happened? It seems like this is what happened.
They genetically engineer, it's because Adrian Brody and his wife, they both end up, because it's like the thing that they make, the genetically enhanced child that matures, they both end up having sex with it.
Right.
Oh my
God. I was
God.
Like, what is this? What is that movie made me feel a little weird.
It made me feel a lot weird.
That was the crash of that year.
It was. Now, David goes on to say that this movie was also bonkers.
Yeah.
It'd make any episode of Manimal look like The Godfather by comparison.
Wow.
I don't know about that, but I like the challenge. At one point in the movie, a dog with enhanced intelligence hides a body to protect its master. My friend and I love that part. Glad to see the idea got used in a better story.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, we'll have to pitch this movie to Dog Studies of Dog Stories. But yeah, the same thing happened in this book. Wow, that's a weird detour. Eldridge Gollum writes, really enjoying your coverage of this novel so far. I wanted to make two comments in reference to your discussion last episode about Zelazny's use of Jack the Ripper as a character. The first thing is that I'm pretty sure that Zelazny's Jack is based on the one from Robert Bloch's short story, Yours Truly, Jack the Ripper, published in the July 1943 issue of Weird Tales. Interesting. In that story, Jack the Ripper is also an immortal sorcerer who must periodically kill in order to maintain his occult powers. I'm almost certain Bloch originated this idea. The second comment I wanted to make is that in following the arguments made by historian Donald Rumbelow in his book Jack the Ripper, The Complete Casebook, and to a lesser extent in Judith Flanders' The Invention of Murder, it is important to remember that Jack the Ripper is a name originating in a letter, the Dear Boss letter, now widely regarded as a hoax, but at the time seized on by the late Victorian era media for its sensational nature. While the five women whose names Chris rightfully read out at the top of the episode were all the victims of someone, the evidence that they were all the victims of the same singularly elusive serial killer is actually pretty scanty. In fact, at the time, 1888, the police initially thought that there were as many as 11 victims of Jack, and it has only recently been pared down to 5, with Rumbelow making a compelling case it should actually be 4 or less. All this to say that I think writers like Bloch and Zelazny are entirely within their rights to use Jack the Ripper as a fictional character, because that's exactly what he is and always was.
Yeah, this kind of blew me away. I didn't know any of this. I was like, what? Because most of my image of Jack the Ripper was this malevolent dude that taunted the police, wrote very specific things about his victims and how he treated them totally like they weren't even people. And then I did a little research. And yeah, there's an article about the Jack the Ripper notes in being a hoax fairly recently, 2018, on the BBC about all of this. And I didn't know.
Let's put that in the show notes. I didn't know that really either.
So yeah, there's a lot of scholarship. So that this guy that wrote those, they've figured out from handwriting analysis, I think, that he was most likely a newspaper reporter sending those in.
Wow.
Getting everybody ginned up to sell more papers.
It's a little like I'm trying to get Melancholoween going. I'm thinking of writing a note to the cops. Whatever I can do to get it into print.
Oh, man. James Cundart writes, thanks for addressing the Gypsy/Roma issue. I feel honored to have my comment shared. There's a documentary about the Romani people in America that may be of interest. The explanation of the title, Searching for the Fourth Nail, at the beginning of the trailer is worth hearing.
And James includes a link, so please check the comments so that you can see that.
Yeah, I watched it. It was the trailer, not the whole movie, mm-hmm. but the trailer was interesting and made me want to watch the whole documentary.
Awesome. Jeppe Mulick writes, I like this book so much. I hope people are reading along with you guys. Your reaction to the Count's demise was very funny. I tend to think that the focus on the familiars, rather than the more monstrous players of the game, is one of the great conceits of the book. It gives you a bit of that Lower Decks feel, highlighting how much of the actual work is carried out by the animal companions.
Right.
Lower Decks is about...
Yeah, the people on a starship in Star Trek that basically do all the crap jobs.
That's a favorite conceit of mine as well. Fringe characters in general... But if it's from a well-established piece of fiction, that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are
right.
dead.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Idea of what's going on with these minor characters. I feel like when the Star Wars franchise is working well, that's what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. it's more like, do I want to know what these main characters were like earlier in their lives, which I've already heard about? Or, mm-hmm. you know, do I want a series on Lobot? Lobot, please.
Yes. Everybody wants more Lobot.
What's that dude's deal?
Christine McCann writes, I'm so happy you're covering this, and it's a delight to hear you discover the Lovecraftian references. I've read this for years and only recently discovered I've been pronouncing Tekla incorrectly. An audio version with Zelazny reading was discovered not too long ago, and it turns out he pronounces it exactly like tequila. Oh. So it's tequila.
That's a convoluted joke.
Is it like a mockingbird? Tequila mockingbird? Kind of? Michelle Stewart writes, I want to say that as much as I love Zelazny, I would not have been able to appreciate this story the way I did without your podcast. I think I read Dracula for the first time before finding you guys, but I had never read Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, nothing by Lovecraft, H.G. Wells, Algernon Blackwood, or Clark Ashton Smith. Had never heard of Charlotte Perkins or M.R. James. And the funny thing is, way back in my youth, I was an English literature major. Thank you, guys. I'm so glad you didn't stop after the Lovecraft stories were exhausted. You unlocked a corner of literature for me that has been completely missed both by my collegiate guided tour and in my own later exploration.
Sure. Well, I can't see when you become an English major, they're not exactly laying out the weird fiction for you to read in your 101.
No, definitely not.
Hawthorne, perhaps, but Matthew Alderman writes, side note, the reading the vicar was doing that Lovecraftian reading in the church that allowed us to realize, oh, he's not a good guy. That reading is a parody of a portion of the Canticle of Canticles, Chapter 2.
Oh.
Reference we didn't pick up on.
Did not pick it up.
Jeremy Impson writes, so hey, does this mean Dr. Watson is an animal familiar?
Yes.
I think it does, kind of. Yeah, that's what I wondered if Sherlock was going to manifest any. He's not technically in the game, so he didn't need to, but
no.
I do think it implied. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Feedback show number 4, Manly the Man. We got some feedback on the feedback. Jeremy Impson again continues on this episode to write the phrases balls to the wall and balls out do not, to my surprise, have the same origin.
Oh.
As mentioned, balls to the wall refers to the throttle stick of aircraft controls, while balls out refers to the steam regulator on a steam engine, which is composed of two or more heavy balls on a valve mechanism. Gravity acting on the balls will close the valve, but steam pressure will push the valve open, causing the balls to lift up. Because they are in a hinge, they spread out as well as up. Thus, a steam engine burning hot and running fast is said to be running balls out. I know no one asked about the origin of balls out, but I felt moved to share anyway. Thank you, Jeremy.
That brings me so much joy. And
this
is
why we can deem ourselves an educational podcast.
Yeah. Jake writes, I kind of like getting a response to my feedback on the feedback episode, and I may have listened to it a few times. It's like getting a personal fan autograph from your favorite podcast celebrities. Thanks, guys. It's a cool show as always.
Oh, it's a feedback loop now. It's a feedback on a feedback on a feedback.
Yes.
But also it's like getting a personal fan autograph from your favorite podcast celebrities. Thanks, Jake. Derek Scott writes, I agree 1,000%. It was a few weeks ago now that I got my first ever thank you from the fellas for being a patron. It came at a time when I had consciously decided to stop listening to most other podcasts in my feed. Whoa. To me, this is all I need. Good stories, comedy, boon companionship with a gang of other supporters. What else can you really ask for?
Aw, man.
Well, thanks, Derek.
That's great. Alashiba writes, I find it totally validates me as a person when they read my comments. Smiley face. Boon companionship forever.
Well, then four is the numeral four.
The numeral forever. Yeah. There's,
it's the print spelling.
Oh, it's the print. Yes, that's it. Yeah. But Alashiba, hopefully that made you feel a little bit better.
Alashiba's getting too strong.
Oh, okay. We'll pair it back now.
Night in the Lonesome October, part three. Megan Marshall writes, thanks for the listen this morning. When you both explained adding video episodes to certain tiers and the follow-up comment of we're effing cute, I cackled. And then when you announced the Monster Squad, I gasped and laughed again with the Nards quote, because that's a mainstay quote in my world. It was a cacophony of sounds for me while getting ready for work. Thanks, y'all. You're welcome, Megan.
You're welcome. Well, thank you. Yeah. Ben A. writes, I'm greatly enjoying your coverage of Zelazny's last book, and I'll have more thoughts to add next week at the conclusion. But I thought I'd note that though Zelazny didn't get around to writing A Night in Lonesome October until 1991, he had planned it in the late 70s. He didn't write it then because Gayon Wilson, yep, he's back again, wasn't available to illustrate. Zelazny abandoned the project and didn't resurrect it until around 1990, and he managed to get Wilson involved. I bring this up since the book followed Monster Squad, but the backbone of the plot predates the movie. Not to say that there aren't some similarities, but I think it's more the monster mashup of established Universal monsters and well-trodden tropes that are the sources of likeness.
For sure. Ben A. continues, also I can add some illumination about who Jack is, at least if you want to take word of God from Zelazny himself. He wrote an essay entitled When It Comes, It's Wonderful, Art Versus Craft in Writing. In the essay, he was commenting about his muse and motivation to write and take risks, including advice from his muse to take a chance, write the story from a dog's viewpoint, and make Jack the Ripper a somewhat sympathetic guy. So, Zelazny intended Jack to indeed be Jack the Ripper, which makes sense at the end, well, in the whimsical universe of Lonesome October, when you realize, ally of Friday the 13th, the series, he could be possessed by a cursed knife.
Yeah.
By the way, I have the DVDs of Friday the 13th, the series now. I do. I haven't started watching it yet, but pretty excited.
Yeah, I don't think they have them in my region, so I would like to somehow get a hold of them. I don't know how that would happen.
You have to go to a little curio shop. Are these... What if you got cursed DVDs of Friday the 13th, the series?
To watch an episode I had to murder somebody?
Yeah.
It'd be worth it. Stacey Kahn writes, I almost wish I didn't know that, because my personal theory was that Jack was intended to be a sort of everyman. Just as with Jack the Ripper and Spring Hill Jack, there are a ton of other Jacks that just kind of mean that guy. Jack the Giant Killer, Jack in the Box, Jack who jumped over the candlestick, even Jack in the Pulpit, a kind of pitcher plant slash hooded flower.
And other commenters were saying there's the Jack who, was the basis of Jack-O-Lantern. Of course, Stacy's forgetting Jack Tripper.
How could you? You know, a lot of people do. And that's why I think we should.
Right. Yes, that makes plenty of sense, Chris.
Exactly.
Thomas Painter writes, your mention of Spring-Heel Jack requires, I tell you, that I disclose the following uncanny connection. The man most suspected of being Spring-Heel Jack was the third Marquess of Waterford, a man so notorious for his hijinks that the phrase paint the town red originated with him.
Oh.
The Marquess's given name was Henry Delapuere.
Oh!
Delapuere, of course, was the name of the accursed family of cannibals and the rats in the walls. As far as I know, until now, I am the only person aware of this connection between Spring-Heeled Jack and the Lovecraft mythos.
Wow.
I have been avoiding assassination attempts by sinister sailors with poison needles for years now. I've always thought there's great potential for a story linking the two. Why would a Delapuere be creeping around London, clawing and scaring people and jumping over walls?
Oh.
But I haven't gotten around to writing it. Maybe one of your listeners will be inspired.
Wow. Wait, that was funny. As you were reading that comment, there was a knock at my door.
Oh, no.
It looks like it's a sailor out there. I wonder...
Don't open it.
I'll let my wife do it.
Good enough.
Ben Gilbert writes, looking forward to your Monster Squad episode. No one remembers the other monster rally from the 80s, the TV movie, The Halloween That Almost Wasn't, with Judd Hirsch as Dracula.
No. Whoa. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
I don't either.
I got to check that out. Judd Hirsch is Dracula? What?
Yeah.
A Night in the Lonesome October, Part 4. Rob Gilly writes, first of all, I love that guitar on Getting Spooky, and this fabulous tune is now part of my Halloween playlist.
Excellent.
It's a great song.
Credit to other Halloween playlists.
Rob goes on to say, I think that Jack and Jill knew that the wands had been switched and went with it. I'm basing this on Jill getting more reluctant to be on the opener's side, but still feeling that she had to honor her commitment. But then a friendly pack rat gave her the out that she wanted. I'm also basing it on wanting those two crazy kids, Snuff and Gray Malk, to live together happily ever after, so I can handle a little possible implausibility if that's what it takes to get those two star-crossed lovers together.
I get it, definitely.
Yeah.
Michelle Albert writes, I hear The Experiment Man is playing the Gobi stage at Coachella next year. Alex Liggett writes, Experiment Man sounds like one of those unlicensed costumes a la Adult Bat Hero and Blue Speed Mouse. It does, which is funny because we were saying that Dracula in Monster Squad looks like he got it out of an adult male vampire from the party store.
Uh-huh. Nils Hedgeland writes, not sure if this has been mentioned yet, but the Lovecraft e-zine did a whole issue on the night in Lonesome October World. Great stuff.
Yeah, we actually used an image of the cover of that magazine on social media. It was a custom cover that had characters from the story linked out to the issue so people would know where it came from. I still recommend people go check it out. It is in our show notes. It's a great issue of the magazine.
Yeah.
Eldritch Golem writes, really enjoyed your coverage of this novel, which remains a favorite of mine. I had forgotten about the reference to Jack being Cain from the Bible. The idea of Cain having a canine companion is a bit of old Jewish folklore, which says that when God marked Cain for having committed the first murder, the mark was a dog. Ancient Near Eastern culture not being as inclined to dogs as we are today.
Ooh.
I also previously made a comment about my thoughts about the use of Jack the Ripper in fiction, and at that time I refrained from commenting on Chad's argument about Dracula. But since he said it again, I just have to point out that Stoker's Count Dracula is not the historical Vlad Dracula. Stoker never says this. Rather, this is a later claim that originates with the popular and heavily influential but historically unsound 1972 book In Search of Dracula. I feel certain that Ken Hite mentioned this in one of your Dracula episodes. That all being said, I think Chad's broader point about the use of historical characters in speculative fiction is still valid. Yeah, I was just making a point. I know that it's not. That part of the joke was me getting it wrong.
Yeah.
I know it's a fictional character. He just cribbed the name because it sounded cool.
Because it is cool. Jeremy Ibsen writes, you know, I'm starting to think that maybe this Jason wears a different elaborate costume to weekly D&D is a bit that Chris is doing. Glad he figured it out by the end of it. And we don't play Dungeons & Dragons. We do tabletop role-playing games. Right now we are playing the Two-Headed Serpent campaign, but we're using, strangely, the Savage Worlds rule system.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind
of
nutty.
None of that made sense to me. But I do want to say that the character of you in that bit was my favorite when you were really tricked by the Invisible Man gambit of him texting you. You're just so weirded out by the whole thing.
Allison Scott writes, useless random fact, Snuff is the name of a dog that appears to no particular purpose in George Eliot's 1861 novel, Silas Marner. Didn't know that. Mark Brett writes, I assume that the plants Talbot and Holmes were researching were a nod to the plants from the 1935 Werewolf of London film, in that two rival werewolves fight over the blooms of this rare plant that can temporarily stop the transformation.
Yeah, I should have called that one.
Didn't notice. I didn't know that. I haven't seen that movie before. I'm aware of it because I had a werewolf movie book when I was a kid that had pictures from it in there, but I've never actually seen the movie.
H.R. Price writes, was the Great Detective a werewolf, or was that simply a cleverly applied wolf wig and dress? Fooled again by the world's greatest detective. Thomas Painter writes, wait a minute. In this world, there are elder things, magic, vampires, werewolves, and also rats that have human-level intelligence and the power of language? Snuff is something that was summoned to be Jack's familiar, maybe some sort of dog or wolf spirit. The squirrel was given super intelligence by the druid. But Bubo is just a random rat who happened along.
Right.
Are all rats smart or just a few? Are all animals smart? After all, the squirrel didn't lose the power of language when he got his shadow back. When the game isn't going on, is this world full of all sorts of intelligent animal hijinks? Is this a shared universe with Ratatouille, Wile E. Coyote, and those penguin movies? Yes. Yes, I believe it is.
Gonna go with that.
Or Bubo comes from the Secret of Nim lab.
Could be.
It's one or the other.
And that gets us into our extra credit episode, The Monster Squad. Carl Haikara writes, I love to hear the unedited, longer episode. I hope you guys keep this format. Great episode.
Yes.
And Eric Gordon says, I like the format for the bonus show. I had to go and rewatch the flick. So bad it's great. I kind of miss the days when so much of the film didn't have to make a lick of sense.
Yeah. Jason Thompson writes, I agree that the best scene is when Dracula is beating the crap out of all the cops. It is awesome. Michelle Albert writes, I think the kids might think Wolfman wouldn't have nards because in a lot of later werewolf movies, you know, the werewolf rips all the clothes off during the transformation and the werewolf form is usually all Ken doll down there, regardless of gender. That's
exactly
true.
Bradley Allen Nord writes, okay, first I must say, longtime listener, first time caller, I love the video viewing viewing format. This is great being able to see you both as you discuss this film. Two things, having never seen both of you before, I really thought your voices and faces should have been swapped in the beginning. But as your discussion continued, my brain finally agreed with the reality. Phew! Also, no mention of the Stephen King Rules t-shirt. I bought my son this shirt 3 years ago when he went to college, and he gets nothing but compliments from professors who are our age. Thank you for your consistency. Your podcast has become a staple in my listening life. Aw, that's great.
That's great.
Thank you.
I wonder if, I didn't know that shirt was for sale. That's pretty awesome. I wonder if you can get some of those shirts that Stiles is wearing in Teen Wolf. Like, what are you looking at, Dick Nose? Those shirts?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to check out this section of the internet. Eric Sroka writes, great timing. I watched this with my kids while carving pumpkins. Definitely things that today are not cricket, but overall, I thought it held up as a goofy Halloween movie. One slight disagreement with Chad. John Grease's character in Fright Night 2, I don't think is a werewolf. He gets chastised for not biting a girl on the neck, is burned by the roses, and gets killed by a stake through the heart or a wooden crossbow bolt anyway. I think he's just a beast-like vampire.
Yeah, he is.
Man,
it's
I screwed that one up.
I knew it when you said it, but I didn't want to correct you.
So you just let me look like a fool. Mark Brett writes, adolescent Fonzie Peeper is my new favorite character archetype. Me too. Favorite bark type, even.
It is a classic archetype. Ellen writes, loved watching you very handsome men live. Drama and comedy is something that is great listening to, but awesome watching because of all the gestures and physicality. I love this video. Would love to see you do more of this if you can. Great. Emily Riley writes, loved watching the live. I started listening on a walk, but I had to check out the video to hear your singing. I like the looser feel of the unedited recording. Nice to know that you are both human.
Our plan is working.
Excellent.
I'm glad that this is working out for you folks, because we got a good video coming up this month, actually. King of All the Snakes, one of our patrons, recommended that we talk about Delta Green. It is the bonus episode, so we don't have to deal with only dead authors. Mm-hmm. And we actually got a living author on the show. Dennis Detweiler came and guested with us to talk about the Delta Green role-playing games and the fiction and how it all started and what it's all about. And it was a really fun conversation. So that's going to be the bonus episode this month. If you're in that tier, you can listen to it or watch it. Monster Talk writes, when Dracula could be incorporeal but is denied, such a missed opportunity. Missed, M-I-S-T. Monster Talk's really bringing the awesome puns. And then we got to close out now, but there was this one comment by Michelle Elbert on this episode that's worth going to the section to read because it's a little longer. But she was trying to explain, she talked about how she was trying to explain Kids Incorporated. It was a show that we referenced. One of the cast members of Monster Squad was also in that show. And she said she was trying to explain Kids Incorporated to a younger person, and her dramatization of this contained this snippet. Todd, what sort of work did they do in this abandoned warehouse? Me. The warehouse wasn't abandoned, Todd. Kids Incorporated was occupying it. Whole thing made me laugh. It is a difficult show to explain. So go to our comments section. There's a lot we don't get the chance to read on these feedback shows. There's links, there's back and forths, interactions, that kind of thing. Please contribute, please read it. Thank you guys all so much for helping us make this show, and that's all we have for this feedback episode.
I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to The Feedback Show, only on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.